This is On the Other Hand.
A podcast that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community members who are working with others across the political divide. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, part of a national organization that aims to reduce political polarization by promoting honest and respectful dialogue among people of all political beliefs. We are continuing our conversation today about political polarization with Jerry Henderson. Today, we're going to be hearing more about the causes of polarization and also get into what influences the levels of toxic polarization in our society. Also, as I promised, we're also at some point going to cover solutions because as bad as some of the things have been that you've heard, we have some ideas about how to make things better. So stay tuned. What else we got, Jerry?
Well, let's talk about some common cognitive errors that promote polarization. One is motivated reasoning. We see and recall information based on our group identity, and we are quicker to dismiss data that goes against our beliefs or group-based values. And in part, this, as you well know, enhances our tendency to distort information to maintain what we believe in.
Yeah, we tend to, skip over, ignore, or minimize things that are not consistent with our current viewpoint. And anytime we see anything that's consistent with our viewpoint, we latch on to it in a big way. So we've kind of psychologically magnified the parts that we agree with and minimized the parts we don't agree with.
Yeah, and it's in one sense, it's kind of lazy information intake. You know, we're not paying enough attention to the facts that are coming in. We're kind of pitching them from the get-go. So.
But to give us a little bit of grace, we also know that we have tended to, in terms of evolution, to develop a habit of making quick decisions, mental shortcuts, I think we call
heuristics,
them earlier,
yeah.
Heuristics, that because that's kind of quicker and more efficient, we don't have to spend so much time thinking. And it's right enough of the time that it works for us. But it also opens us up to more error as well.
Sure.
I get the impression that all of this stuff worked really well when you had a more primitive, biological, live-and-die kind of environment, whereas now in a society with all the rules and systems in place, that's when it's exposing its weaknesses.
Sure. Okay. Sure. Sure. When the Gallup Group polled Americans in the week before the presidential election, I think that was 2016,
yeah.
Democrats and Republicans flipped their perceptions of the economy, but nothing had actually changed about the economy.
I remember that. That was remarkable.
Yeah.
Do you have the actual stats? Because it was pretty remarkable.
I don't have the stats, but it was definitely the 2016 election.
So basically it was like, if I remember, my summary is that the 2 weeks before the 2016 election, conservatives, who obviously were going to go for Trump, had really overall bad negative ratings of the health of the economy, and liberals were just the opposite. They had pretty positive views because they'd been through Obama and all. And then 2 weeks after the election, by far not enough time for any changes to happen, things had kind of reversed. The conservatives, you ask them what they thought about the health economy, oh, it's really good. And the liberals say, no, it's really getting pretty bad. So there's this huge difference, this swapping and reversal of positions in a situation, in a time frame where there is no possible way it could have made any appreciable difference.
No, none at all.
So that's you're saying that's part of that cognitive error kind of thing that
we
do. We are so,
and you can,
it's a group-related kind of, error that we're making.
Yeah, and you can see how it would add to polarization.
Sure.
So another cognitive error is termed confirmation bias. And this is a tendency to search for, interpret, and favor, and even recall information in a way that confirms our pre-existing beliefs or hypothesis. And I think we're going to see for that, media bubbles that we get into are kind of what that is telling us about how biased we are. We seek out information that settles our biases and makes us feel like, oh, yeah, I got it right.
So. Well, what it's telling me is that we have that tendency anyway. We don't need any help with it. But with social media and its algorithms, boy, do we really have a lot of external help to support the way we believe it. We're only exposed to the things that fit what we already believe.
Yeah, and it's so easy to get that, as you're implying these days, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So.
Evidence indicates that political polarization makes citizens more vulnerable to the impact of disinformation. And other research has shown that humans frequently engage in this type of motivated reasoning, and it's very much keeps our polarization going because we keep feeding our self-information consistent with our biases. There's also some recent research that indicates motivated reasoning is primarily triggered by identity protective cognition. In other words, it engages more around things that we have an affective commitment to in some ways. So this would suggest that in the political arena, that if it triggers our existing party values, then it's going to make a difference in how much distortion we're apt to show. So,
okay. What else we got?
Well, we got some additional research here about disinformation congruent with political identity and linked to anger and resentment even further enhances the likelihood that it will be believed.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Well, it's basically if a politician arouses our anger and then gives us disinformation, we're more apt to then believe it and remember it.
Okay, well, that makes sense. That makes sense because that arousal of anger, that's emotion, and I think I'd mentioned earlier about the notion of the emotional versus rational mind. The emotional is very good at latching onto something because it thinks survival's a threat now, but it's not so good at making good fine-tuned judgments. That's what the rational part of our brain is better at, and if the emotional urges are crowding that out, we're not making good decisions and good judgments.
Right.
So it pays to make people angry.
It does.
A politician, gosh.
That's kind of sad, isn't it?
It is. But we need to know that so we know what to do.
Right. Related phenomenon, this is interesting to me, called backfiring, describes a tendency of individuals to retrench and dig in defense of disinformation consistent with their political identity. Even when confronted with clearly disconfirming information. So you almost get the sense that some of these mechanisms of distortion work like a turtle. You know, I don't want to hear anything contrary to my party, you know.
It jeopardizes something really deep and vulnerable.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in a kind of summary here of some of these issues, you know, one might argue that when we view politics through the partisan prism, we tumble into a Alice in Wonderland world of motivated reasoning in which we tend to see what we want to see and we hear what we want to hear. We become unmoored from rational disagreement over policy outcomes, blind to our commonalities, and caught in the current of emotionality-driven desire to defeat the other side. And tragically, despite the cost of this battle, we just keep fighting.
I think it's important to notice, because that's such a bleak appraisal of the situation, and I think you're right from everything I've seen. That is the tendency. But I hope people understand that even though that's the tendency and that's what maybe our brain and our body has been doing for millennia, there are ways out of this, or at least ways to combat it and move in a more healthy direction. And that's the kind of stuff we'll get to later on when we get into solutions and approaches to improve polarization. So don't give up on the human race just yet.
No. And I mean, part of what I think we're doing in this conversation is cueing people in to this is where we can fall off the path. This is where we can begin to actually go against our own best interests, you know, and add to polarization.
Okay. You know, I was thinking I probably should have jumped in earlier when you were talking more about like misinformation and confirmation bias and that and motivated reasoning. I thought it was worth, though, going back and revisiting a couple other things that to me seem important that relate to political polarization. And this, I think, is helpful to people when they're having individual conversations, is to recognize when this is happening, realize that you may be going down the wrong road. One of them is called false dichotomy. This is where you get into argument and you claim there are only two options. You know, I'll give you one example. If you remember back after 9/11, George W. Bush, the president at the time, made the famous speech where he said, "You're either with us or you're with the terrorists."
Yeah.
He gave, if it's black and white, there were no places in between. And there may be times when that's true, but often there are multiple considerations and multiple truths that don't just easily divide into one or the other. There's a whole nother idea called competing goods that I think is important to think about. And the competing goods idea is that, let's say you've got a liberal and conservative arguing something. Let's say the liberal wants security and the conservative wants freedom, okay? And you could easily put it the other way, but let's just say we go that way. So the liberal wanting security says, "No, I'm right, you're wrong. How could you possibly argue against the need for us to be secure in our own homes and not be, you know, vulnerable to crime?" Conservative would say, "What's the matter with you? How in the world could you not want freedom? If you don't have freedom, you don't have anything."
Yeah.
Well, what they fail to realize is they both security and freedom are important values. They both need to be considered in some fashion. They've turned it into a competition between one or the other. It's not one or the other. It's both and. So the question becomes, how do you balance that? Where do you decide to settle on that gets the best security you can get while maximizing your freedom? That's always going to be somewhere in a broad middle range. So those false dichotomies that get you to thinking one or the other, ask yourself if it might be that maybe both sides have a point. We need to get together and find some compromise that kind of splits the difference enough that we can both live with it.
Yeah, and I think if you took the Braver Angels approach and you were truly in that conversation seeking understanding rather than proving your point, it might go better.
Yeah, then you might actually come to appreciate, oh, okay, you do have a good point. That doesn't negate my point, but my point doesn't negate yours either.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a little more complex. That requires a lot of that rational thinking things through that our evolution doesn't prepare us to do as quickly as does it.
No.
Okay. Another one I was going to think about was the boomerang effect. Some of you may have heard of this, and this is the notion. This is important in dealing with misinformation. There's a lot of misinformation out there now. So how do you handle it? Well, for a while, people were saying, well, you just have to kind of call it out. And then some research seemed to find out that even if something is wrong, if you tell people, you know that idea? That's wrong. Well, what they don't realize is there's something built into our brain that when we hear repetition of an idea, it sticks. So if you keep citing the wrong notion, the misinformation, you're inadvertently helping cement it into place in the person that's listening to you, even though you're trying to explain it's wrong. There's that natural tendency to pay attention to. So as a result, what some people say is you need to minimize repeating the wrong thing and maximize talking about the reality and the truth. And it helps to give evidence for that, but you know, the rational evidence is not enough. So if you really want to maximize your ability to combat misinformation, minimize repeating the misinformation and maximize, you know, stating the positive, accurate.
Could statement. You possibly convince politicians of that?
Well, you know, at one point, I think they tried to do that with Obama back in 2008. One of the psychologists working with him, because at the time, you know, there was the whole notion that, oh, Obama is secretly a Muslim. And they said, how are we going to do
this? And wasn't born in the country.
Right, all sorts of things that was misinformation. And so he was asking the opinion of some of the experts what to do. And Dr. Swartz said, in no case should you say that Obama is not a Muslim. Now, yes, that was the advice that was given, which was, you can understand why they said that based on the research that was coming out then. The boomerang effect is if you try to refute the misinformation and repeat it, it boomerangs on you, makes it actually more entrenched for many people.
Yeah.
So they said that, but I think since then the research has shown it's still a powerful thing, but you can combat it if you do what I was saying. You minimize repeating it only just enough to, and characterize it immediately as false information, and spend your time given the correct information and the evidence why it's correct.
Yeah.
So that's that part. The other thing, the final thing I was going to mention was the Dunning-Kruger effect, which many people know is kind of like people don't know what they don't know. So they think they know more than they do. You know. Now, that has been used to cast aspersions against people who maybe aren't as bright, and it's true. You know, you may not know as much, and so you tend to overestimate how much knowledge you have about a thing. In fact, the old saying goes with the really smart people, they know how much they don't know. You know, but before you get tempted to put down the folks who are really, you know, in your mind, stupid, and they're just, you know, they don't get it because they don't know, and they don't know, they don't know. Be aware of this. It's also true, and one of the ones who makes this point is Dr. Cahan, a psychologist at Yale, and others have noticed this too. The smarter you are, the better you're able to rationalize to yourself why you believe something. So both, it doesn't matter how intelligent or not intelligent you are, we are all susceptible to believing the wrong thing or to convincing ourselves of something and not being able to easily get away from something when it's wrong.
Yeah, that's...
I'm going off a little bit on a tangent, but I think it helps make the point. You remember that in Dr. Height's book, The Righteous Mind, the metaphor of the elephant and the rider?
Yeah, actually that occurred to me when you were talking.
Yeah. So, okay, so here's the, folks, this is the notion. Think of an elephant walking down the road and there's a rider on the elephant. The elephant turns a certain way. Now, normally you'd look at that and you'd think, okay, the rider is directing the elephant. Well, in Dr. Height's metaphor, the elephant represents the non-conscious, tribal, emotional factors that we've been talking about all this time that are driving our decision-making. And the rider is the rational part of our brain that's analyzing things. And according to Dr. Height, the evidence is that the vast majority of the decisions we make are motivated and driven by these relatively unconscious emotional and tribal factors. So we make decisions, we make a turn, not because the rider thought it through and said, oh, we need to go right here, but because all these old primitive things were driving us there. The rider, or the rational part of the brain, what they're doing is they're simply saying, okay, my elephant went right. Okay, how can I come up with a reason to explain why and then they just invent using their intellect and their rational thinking abilities an explanation that seems plausible to explain why the elephant went right.
Didn't he make the metaphor that the rider was more like the press secretary of the president?
That's the other metaphor, yeah. Yes, that, tell me your understanding of that, but that's right, that was another thing he mentioned.
Well, the executive power is there and makes the decision, and let's say it's turning into something rather problematic. The press secretary is going to come out there and give an ad hoc, rationality for what a good decision it was after the fact.
Or maybe in some cases, well, he didn't really say that, or he didn't really mean that.
Right.
What he really meant was.
Yeah.
I want to mention a little bit about some research looking at the characteristics of people who have extremist political beliefs, because I think this is really important to know, because one of the things that political polarization does when it's high enough, it tends to drive people to more extreme positions. And that's a bad thing. Well, according to a 2019 study that looked at the political extremists on both sides, they compared to moderates, there was actually a lot of similarity. You could put the extremists on both sides, left and right, into one category and the moderates in another category, because the extremists on both sides shared these things. Extremists were more likely to be engaged in the political struggle. They get involved. They vote at much higher rates. They're more likely to donate money and wind up donating more money than moderates. They're more likely to volunteer and be an activist. And here's an interesting thing. They are more vulnerable to misinformation, particularly if it's against the other side. And that fits with some of the stuff you were talking about before, the group identity thing. And then the extremists on both sides tend to have a propensity to believe in simple solutions to complex problems and tend to be overconfident in their beliefs. And then probably the saddest part is that when a person develops extreme political beliefs, they become less willing to cooperate with the other side. They're less willing to hear other views. They're less willing to compromise. They're even less willing to rule out violence.
Are you talking about Congress now?
Well, I'm talking about extremists, and I think it's probably at this point a safe bet that there are a number of them in Congress as well as in the general population. Well, okay, we need to move on. We've had enough downer information in this whole thing. I hope it's been helpful and instructive, but let's get to concluding about what can we do to solve or at least help influence in a positive direction the difficulties associated with toxic political polarization. How do we reduce it? How do we fight against it? So, Jerry, I know you have some things you could talk about there, don't you?
There's some there. There's what can we do on an individual level, one-to-one? What can we do as a voter about how our voting pattern and maybe how we can contribute on a higher level to community levels of polarization. But one of the most interesting studies I ran across recently was a study in which they had two groups and they exposed them to nostalgia for a time in a country's history when there was much more camaraderie, there was much less polarization and tension and conflict. And by introducing that and talking about it, wasn't it great back when, we weren't mad all the time at the other side? This took hold to some extent and seemed to last a while. So I think if we could put down our weapons, so to speak, politically, and think, wow, what would it be like if things were more like they were, back in the 50s when congressmen and congresswomen were civil to one another and made good decisions and solved problems, So that's one possibility, yeah.
Okay. That's a good point. There are a lot of other things we can look at, but you make the good point that, we have individual as well as group things. And I think for group things, those tribal tendencies we've talked so much about, we're going to have to rely upon leaders to do the right thing.
Right.
But on an individual basis, it starts with being willing to look at ourselves and assess our motivations and where we are with some courage. Because, let's face it, none of us likes to be wrong, particularly if we've been wrong for a while. So it takes courage to be willing to look at yourself and examine yourself and your motivations and to look at other people's arguments. But I think that's ultimately what we're going to all have to do. You know, what are we possibly doing to contribute to the problem, or are we contributing to the greater good? So that self-assessment piece is really important, and not everybody's comfortable doing that. So you have to have develop some confidence in yourself that it's okay if I'm wrong sometimes. I'm a good person if I become aware of that and change and go in a good direction. Another thing that I think is important for people to understand, if you're thinking about, no, our side has to win. This is an existential crisis. It's a battle for our country. Well, I understand how people can view that way, but understand that liberals and conservatives need each other. This is something that David Brooks, one of my favorite journalists and authors, does, and he's been conservative, but he talks about how you make better decisions when you have more information. And when you have both sides at the table trying to work out a compromise and being willing to listen to each other's ideas, you're going to have more productive ideas and information, and you're going to get closer to the truth. So his quote on that is, "Politics is a competition between partial truths. Most issues are competing goods," which is a point I made earlier. The other thing that I want to say that I think is a positive and gives us some hope, we've talked a lot about the primitive, evolutionarily derived tribal natures of our beliefs and our behaviors, which might give people the erroneous idea that there's no hope, that we can't do anything about it because it's so deep and ingrained. But that's not true. We have the ability to influence all those primitive emotions, those tribal urges, those biases. We can actually change our brains. And we know this from our field when we look at things like treating certain mental illnesses with medication or psychotherapy, and some of the modern research, like in neuroimaging, shows that you can actually have improvements, let's say in depression, but it's true in other things too, but let's say in depression, you can improve a person with depression through antidepressant medication, and you can see on a neuroimaging, the image produced by a neuroimaging device, that it really does make some changes in how the brain functions in a good way. Yeah. It's consistent with what we think about what happens in the brain when we're depressed. But it's also true, and this is something people don't know, that the modern studies also show that if you use non-biological interventions, like certain types of psychotherapy that have been shown to be helpful in depression, that also has not only the success of improving the symptoms and reducing depression, you can do an MRI or a PET scan and see the differences in the brain before and after the psychotherapy. So I want people to get the idea that there is hope for changing, and you're not prisoners of our brains and emotions. There's a great quote Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Gave that I think encapsulates that pretty well. He said, "Each of us is two selves, and the great challenge of life is to try to keep that higher self in command."
Sure.
Yeah.
And one point would be that while some of our discussion has had a kind of heavy tone, if we don't realize that we're anchored in those kind of instinctual places, we may think that we could get in shape without exercising. If we're going to change, we have to accept it's going to take some work, and we have to appreciate I have these tendencies not because I'm bad, because I'm human.
That's a good point. And just like with exercise, you have to actually do the exercise, you have to do it, and you have to repeat it.
Yeah.
Because the more you repeat it, the better you get. But if you quit and give up for a while, you kind of go back, you backslide. Good point. So let's look at some psychological skills that are used in our field in psychotherapy and other things that show promise for helping us bridge the polarizing gap. One, Remember we've talked about tribes and how we identify with certain tribes? Well, how about if we try to identify with larger tribes than we're currently in? Instead of thinking of ourselves as Republicans versus Democrats, how about we think about ourselves as Americans, or even bigger, humans, you know, because that incorporates everybody and makes us part of that same group. It has to come from the higher part of our brain to think of that way instead of going to the lower common denominator. But that's a good way to look at it. There's another thing, too, in our field we talk about emotion regulation, which is basically a variety of skills that help people learn to recognize their emotional responses and gradually start to work, you know, like with exercise, repeatedly work at getting better at managing your emotions. So since so much of emotion is involved in our decision-making and our beliefs, if we can learn to regulate our emotion more, that's helpful. There's a whole body of work on conflict resolution efforts. And to give you just a few ideas of things that can help with that, one is, if you're having a conversation with someone who's different, don't ask them to change their views and don't expect them to change their views. And don't just rely upon logic and your superior rational factual basis. Because when you do that, people dig in. They get more defensive and you lose any hope of them hearing you. So instead of wanting them to change their views, make it easy for them to hear you, to listen to you so they can hear your viewpoint. That means you have to keep your emotions in check and try to keep the emotions at moderate levels when you're conversing with them. You want to communicate rather than persuade, basically.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, if we could get into the saddle with, I'm going to interact with you because I want to understand you, and you're worthy of my effort.
Yeah. I may never agree with you.
Right.
I may be convinced you're wrong, but I still value you as a human being, and so I'd like to hear where you're coming from. Which brings up another point. One of the things that's really helpful in helping people understand where you're coming from, facts are great. Stories actually are better. They're more persuasive. If you can tell a person a story about, you know, I believe this so strongly because when I was growing up, here's what I was taught, or here's what I experienced as an adult. Here's what I found out as in my career. You know, whatever it is, right. Tell personal stories that help the person understand where you're coming from. That humanizes you, and they're less likely to treat you as someone with a fatal parasite that jeopardizes their existence. And then there's a whole area of communication skills that many people have heard about. There's the idea of listening carefully by hearing what they have to say and then reflecting back to them what you heard. It's called reflective listening or active listening. But it's basically just, it's rather than listening so that you can combat what they had to say with your own points, listening to understand what they're saying and why they said that. And then let them know you heard it by saying, so I gather from what you're saying, you are thinking, and then you kind of reflect back in your own words what they said. That's a powerful communication skill. And then another thing is get to know them better. Understand more where they're coming from by asking them genuine questions of understanding, not gotcha questions. Gotcha questions are, when did you stop beating your wife?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or how could you possibly vote for someone who's killing our country? You know, that's not a real question. That's just another form of attack. So ask something. So you're voted for Biden, and you still would vote for him again. Can you help me understand what it is about his policies and his actions and his administration that help you think that's a good idea? So you're not impugning their motives or anything. You're just saying, give me some information, help me understand. And then there, when it's your turn to speak, so you do a lot more listening than speaking at first, but there is time to speak your mind, but do so gently and respectfully. Be humble about it. So rather than say, I heard what you say, but here's the truth. Now, don't make the truth statements. Instead, be a little humble about it. Say something like, well, I hear what you're saying. My viewpoint is this. The way I see it is, I'm seeing it this way, okay, and then as I'd said before, the idea of a story so people can understand where you come from, that's really powerful. And, you know, if things get really bad, it's okay to bail. Just do so gently and respectfully. Find a way to use some humor maybe to say, well, I guess we really solved that one. Well, I'll see you later. Or if worse comes worse, like, well, I don't want to jeopardize our relationship any further, so maybe we ought to just stop and move on. We'll talk later.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. If you're finding yourself heating up with a good friend or family member, it's better to bail than get caught in some, you know, real bad exchanges.
Yeah. Well, we're about to wrap up, so maybe we can give some a couple of summary statements, if you will. I'll start. There's so much we could say, but I would just say be a little more respectful of all the complex factors that are involved in people developing their political views and the behaviors that result from that. So be prepared to be a little more forgiving and understanding. Now, obviously, there are limits to that if people are really extreme and they're doing things that they're actively working against you, being violent or, you know, hostile. It's time to get out of that conversation and go elsewhere. So you need to talk with people where you might have a chance to talk with them. But understand how difficult this is, evolutionarily speaking, from what we've heard, and try to engage with people with different viewpoints in a respectful way. And the bottom line here is you're not after change as much as you might like to. Don't go for change. Go for deepening the relationship. Because developing a relationship with someone is probably the single most powerful thing you can do to help smooth out the edges, dampen down the emotion, and reduce the animosity, and to make both sides see the other as a human being. You know, the whole the Nazi solution happened because they were able to dehumanize the Jews with propaganda and some of the same things we've been talking about. So try to humanize people so you don't go in that direction. So if I had the final summary, I would say would be listen to understand, speak respectfully, develop the relationship, and keep it up. What about you? Do you have any final
comments? Well, I think you summed a lot of good things up well. I think this humility notion is important. And I think to appreciate we're shoving uphill on this. There's a lot of things that get in our way of seeing the humanity in another human being. So I think you might sum it up as say, be kind to the other side and try to understand them.
You know, Jerry, that's wonderful. And it reminds me, Aldous Huxley was famous for having said something near the end of his life, and I'll probably mangle it a bit, but it was something like, it's a little bit embarrassing to be at this late stage of life, and the best I can say to suggest how we can improve ourselves is try to be a little kinder.
Yeah.
Jerry, thank you so much for being here. This has been a great conversation. We've covered a lot. I hope people find it helpful and interesting. I'd encourage you to Google some of the information that we've talked about and find out more because it's so complex. But thank you for being here.
I enjoyed it, Glenn.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this edition of On the Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed this part of our discussion on polarization with Jerry Henderson. Be sure to check out the rest of our conversation and future podcast episodes of On the Other Hand on the Braver Angels Arkansas website. That address is arkansas.braverangels.org. And you just go to the podcast page from there. We'd like to hear from our listeners. We'd like to know what feedback you have for us, what you like about our program, any suggestions you have for improvement, especially any ideas for speakers or topics that you'd like to see us cover. But basically, whatever you want to share with us, all you got to do is just email it to us. So if you go to the Braver Angels Arkansas website on the podcast page, you will find a link to send us a Gmail, and that email address is otherhandar, no spaces, @gmail.com. That's otherhandar@gmail.com. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor. I'm your host, Glenn White. Have a good evening, and let's keep the conversation going as we work to bring our community closer together.